Good evening, you guys. I'm K2 Romeo India Whiskey. My name is Dick. I was dialing a little bit later than normal. You guys have heard the so-called introduction lots and lots of times. I get tired of hearing it. There's always a few new people joining the net for the tech net for the first time, and they don't know what it's all about. So I give a little bit of an explanation as to what it is and why we're here, and why this particular group of people gather each Sunday night to educate each other about how radio really works. As I said, I'm K2 Romeo India Whiskey. My name is Dick. You'll also be hearing from John, KC2WGB. John maintains the mailbag and also monitors the Echo Link. After that, you'll hear Paul, WS2N, who gives us a space report. And the space report could be fairly exciting tonight because during this week, SpaceX did manage to take a very large booster that accelerated something into orbit, a real payload, and then the booster itself came all the way back to Cape Kennedy or Cape Canaveral and landed tail first. That's the first in history that's ever been done. So therefore, it doesn't have to get dumped into the water and be recycled. Let me drop. So the that particular vehicle. Doesn't have to be recycled by the extended technique of picking it up out of the ocean and cleaning it up and putting it all back together. So they're going to save a whole lot of time and money by that particular process. If we also have enough time tonight, someone made a request that we discuss fast Fourier transformer, or Fourier transforms in general, and also it's related to the way you can get a fixture that you add to your service monitor that will tell you distance to fault, and that can be very handy at times. Knowing how many feet downrange in your cable is the grief that you're getting. During the first hour, we accept people who check in with a question or a comment. They give us their call letters, their name. And then we and you also give us the word yes, which means they do have a question or a comment. You need that sign in just because we're listening. You're listening. This is TechNet number 1582 of the series that began in September of 1982. So the TechNet's been around for 33 years. By now, we believe somebody is listening. That doesn't have to be proven anymore. So in the very beginning, we used to take very long lists of people signing in. That just took a lot of time and didn't really contribute to the main function of the TechNet, which is education. So, we got Paul's report to look forward to. Later on, we'll be discussing a Fourier transform, maybe even mix in a little bit of the S parameters. What is it called now? The Smith chart. Okay. Does anybody want to give us their call letters and name right now because they have a question or a comment? K2LIW listening.
K2J, yes.
MDG, Steve, and yes.
So far, Eric, KE2EJ, and Steve. I didn't catch Steve's call letters. Anyone else to check in? Give me your call letters right now, K2RAW and the Tech Minute. Okay, let's pick up Eric first. KE2EJ, K2RAW. Go ahead, Eric.
Hi, K2RW, K2J. Here's my question. I've got an issue that I'm working on. Now, if I take a diode, and I put it at the end of... What's going on here? Oh, yeah. And I put it at the end of a piece of coax, or let's call it a quarter wave segment of line. We're going to be doing this at 430 megahertz to 450 megahertz. And I make that diode look like a short at the end of the quarter wave line. The input end of the quarter wave line is going to look like a very high impedance. Are you with me so far?
Yes, sir. Yes, I am. What's the wheels going to use when the impedance that you see will be strongly a function of how strong is the signal. As the signal gets stronger and you turn the diode on, you'll get a very different impedance than if it's a very weak signal. A very weak signal, yes, the diode will look like an open circuit. And also, whether or not there's any DC bias on it will make a difference. And whether or not it's a pin diode will make a difference. Go ahead, Eric. K2EJ, K2IW.
All right, here's the idea. It's going to be a single pole, double throw switch with two pin diodes. One's going to short at the quarter wave line, and the other one's going to, one's going to be open, and one's going to short. So we're going to feed like a TR switch, RF out and RF into the receiver through the quarter wave line. Now, my question is, how can I make that, or how can I create that network, because it's going to be a network, it's not going to be a hunk of coax. How can I make it so that it works over 20 megahertz? As an example, radio is going to be able to go between 430 and 450, and I don't want to change the length of the quarter wave line across that particular bandpass. K2RW, K2J.
That's not a better answer. If I understand you correctly now, you want it to work at 430 and 450. Hello, this week has got to, until it warms up, the audio. Got to fix this week. Until it warms up, the audio will periodically drop out. The quarter wave matching transformer does give an impedance inversion. Apparently, you want to use that. In other words, when the diode is a short circuit, the quarter wave away, at the input end of that quarter wave, you see an open circuit. And I think you're going to be using that as a kind of a switching network, if I understand correctly. Are you trying to back off a little bit and tell me what are you really trying to do? Are you trying to have two separate transmitters going through the same piece of cable and them automatically be selected as to which one goes to the antenna? Give me a couple of words as to what is the overall intention with this network, Eric. K2EJ, K2RIW.
All right, first let's take a look at it, the traditional method. Okay, you have the input to the receiver, which might be a little bandpass filter or just the front end of an RF stage. Right at the input of the receiver, it will see a pin diode, which goes to ground, okay, and that'll be decoupled from the input of the receiver to get the DC bias out of it. And then the other side of the quarter wave line, which is connected to the diode and the input of the receiver, goes to an antenna. And from that point, we go through another diode, another pin diode, in a series mode, and we go through another coupling capacitor, and that connects to the output of the transmitter. Okay, you with me so far? And that's pretty traditional. There's nothing unusual about that.
Okay, Quinto. What I think I'm hearing so far is a pin diode in shunt at the receiver, so that when you're in the transmit mode, the receiver is being protected by that short circuit of the pin diode being turned on. A quarter wave away, if I understand correctly, you've got a pin diode in series that, with a quarter wave length of line, I'm guessing, goes to a transmitter. So that enables the transmitter to go to the antenna. I presume there's a T connector here somewhere and I haven't heard about that yet. Back to you, Eric. K2LAW.
No, you basically got it right. I just used the word T-connector, whereas the output of the quarter wave line actually goes directly to the antenna, coupled to a small capacitor. And the antenna is also coupled through a small capacitor to another series pin diode that's coupled through another small capacitor. And the reason the small capacitor is at a DC block, that connects to the output of the transmitter. So you have the transmitter, and it doesn't matter whether it's a quarter wave or not, the distance between the output of the transmitter and the diode and the T-connector. And now you have a quarter wave segment of line at the frequency between the T-connector and the shunt diode and the input and receiver. Got that so far?
I think I do. And it sounds to me like you're using pin diodes because you want to be able to switch very fast. I think this is a DMR afterburner that you're adding. Is that true, Eric? Go ahead.
Yeah, I didn't really want to bring that into the picture, but yeah, that creates a whole other problem. I actually have it working, but I want to make the quarter wave line, or rather the network that I'm using, appear, or at least be efficient across the 20 megahertz bandwidth.
The quarter wave matching transformer is a very broadband device. You're worried about the, if you tune it for 430, will it still work at 450? You actually study with a Smith chart or with the mathematical equivalent what happens to a quarter wave impedance matching transformer when you put shorts and opens at the far end. It's not as sharp as you think. So I think your main question now is that if the pin diode acts sufficiently like a short circuit, I think a good pin diode with heavy forward bias, I believe you can bring it down to a fraction of an ohm at the RF frequency. That's darn close to a short circuit. As such, the open end, the quarter wave away end, is going to see thousands of ohms, and therefore to a 50 ohm system, it is a pure open circuit. So I think you're asking now what happens if you put a diode at the end of a quarter wave matching transformer as opposed to a real short or open. Is that sort of the nature of the real question? Over to you, Eric, K2LAW.
Actually, no. I built a network that is my quarter wave line that I calculated at about 440. And as I move up towards, I move down towards 430, and I move up towards 450, I begin to get a little bit of coupling through the diode. How do I say it? It's not through the diode because the diode is making the short to ground, but I get a little bit of leakage. Let's put it that way.
Okay, your definition of leakage now, because a receiver has, in some cases, close to 100 decibels of dynamic range, the difference between a dead full quieting 60 over 9 signal versus a threshold signal can be a huge bunch of dBs. Your diode, pin diode attenuator may knock your signal down by, let me pick a number, 70 dB, but still the signal may be above threshold, and so therefore making a judgment as to whether or not the pin diode is doing its thing becomes a little bit more of a definition of how many dB of rejection that you expect to get. So let me back off on that one. You would like the pin diode to give you how many decibels of rejection at the place where you're putting it. Over you, Eric, K2LAW.
Let me turn that down. Okay, I'm looking for, 70 is actually a pretty good number. And on frequency, I get it. I can only get as far as I can read my service monitors I'm using. It's really only good to about minus 75, minus 80 in that neighborhood. And I'm starting with a signal that's at zero. So I could raise it and see what the difference is. And in a normal situation with a receiver, that's really not a problem because you're switching from transmit to receive, you're shutting the receiver off, there's maybe 50 microvolts or 100 microvolts, so you're not going to do anything bad, you don't care about it. Now comes the area where I have the problem. Let me describe the circuit, because here what we're doing is we have an antenna which has traffic going both directions, okay? And what we want to do is in one direction apply some amplification. And then let me tell you how I get to do that. Okay. So, essentially, if we can talk about this as it is, you got a handheld radio which has an antenna connector. That is going to, in essence, go into a T, if you want to think of it that way. Okay. You got a pair of diodes blocking a what could be a halfway path between the radio and the antenna. And then you have another path which has a quarter wave line and another half wave after, another quarter wave after it that connects to the antenna. The one that's straight through, and in fact has an amplifier in it. And what I'm trying to do is prevent a feedback loop. You following me?
Yeah, that's a tough one. If you're trying to put amplification into a line where the input and output frequency of that amplification, input and output frequency are one and the same, and it's part of a switching network, and you desire the forward signal to do the right thing, you're not using circuit. You're not using circulators, and you want the whole thing not to turn in, not to turn in.
Go back to 25.
Yeah, let me switch antennas. Yeah, hopefully this will sound a little bit better. You want the whole thing not to break into oscillation, where you're building an F1, F1 repeater, as we call it, and you're hoping the switching network will allow the signal flow in the right direction and yet give enough attenuation for the feedback path. And by the way, you know that there are ways of cascading pin diodes, not just putting more of them in parallel. There's a fancy way of cascading pin diodes so you can get any number of decibels of rejection you want. You could use a network of pin diode attenuators in a line that could give you 110 dB of attenuation when you put them in the attenuate mode, and when you put them in the pass mode, you might have a dB of loss, dB and a half. So there are ways of cascading them with quarter wavelengths of line between them in order to increase the amount of attenuation. You might have to do that from what I'm hearing. Over to you, Eric, K2RIW.
All right, K2RIW, K2J. Actually, I have it working, but as I started to tune off the frequencies where I'm interested in, then I started to run into a little bit of a problem. Do understand that the path into the amplifier actually has a pad. It's got a 20 dB attenuator in the path because, you know, I don't want to be stuffing 5 watts into the input of an amplifier that wants 100 milliwatts, so I got to do something there, which helps. I mean, it's only when I get to the extremes that I have a problem. So the fact that the quarter wave line really does the killing for me, because I didn't think I needed to do it. I actually started by doubling up on the pin diode, which gives you more isolation. But because this is short duration stuff, it's actually the burst of 20 milliseconds wide. And the thing that bothers them, it's not the fact that it's a little bit leaky. What it does is it accentuates the overshoots at the switch, because there's a little bit of propagation time between when I detect the RF coming in and actually switch the amplifier in. When I'm within the range of the network that I built, it works just fine and dandy. So what I'm really asking for is how do I mean, I could calculate it more as a bandpass filter rather than a quarter wave line at one single frequency, but that makes me scratch my head a little bit.
With a thorough enough study, with something like a antenna analyzer, vector network analyzer, you could find out what is happening to the impedances at various places as you change the frequencies. Apparently it's working at one frequency and then another frequency is not working. So if you make the right kind of a vector network analyzer measurement at the frequency where it's not working well, there's ways where you could create a stub that only comes into action at that particular frequency. So you could add an auxiliary network to cancel the reactants that you're seeing at the frequency where it's not working well. That might be the next step if you're not willing to go to multiple pin diodes in order to get a greater amount of on-off ratio. Over to you, Eric, K2LAW.
The phone, it won't do that. Well, yeah. I actually have tried the increased isolation. That works pretty well to a degree. And when I'm working with a quarter wave line, because the impedance looks something like 7 or 8 K in that neighborhood, when I look at the final output, everything looks cool. When I go more than about, say, 8 or 10 megahertz away, then I start to see these artifacts that bother me, and I know it's from a little bit of leakage coming back in, being attenuated by the attenuator, picked up by the amplifier, and flopped around. And really, it's just during the turn-on time of the amplifier that the problems appear, because it's literally ramping up, and that's what I'm trying to overcome. So, I mean, the basic circuit, the basic concept works across the 20 megahertz, but these little overshoot artifacts that begin to occur, which actually disrupts the digital signal, it causes the overshoots get in the way of the information that's being transmitted back by the radio. Because don't forget, it's every 20 milliseconds, it's switching from transmit to receive, the repeater is doing just the opposite.
There are ways of critically damping that overshoot. A real study of those transients every 20 milliseconds in the overshoot. There's ways to critically damp that. I didn't say it's easy. Another thing worth worrying about here, Eric, is that if I was laying out pin diodes on a printed circuit board with lengths of coaxial cable, quarter wavelength long, maybe semi-rigid coax, with a typical layout, the undesired path in air around the coax in your particular enclosure could be, let me pick a number, 70 or 80 dB down, because the network of the pin diodes hanging at the far end of a coax cable might not itself be in a thoroughly shielded box. You might be getting radiated EMI within your own circuit. Is there any possibility of that, Eric? KE2EJ, K2LAW.
Well, I'm not using coax. I'm using a coil and a couple of capacitors. And the end goal is to make a PC board pattern that does your job. Now, that I didn't think of. That's an interesting thought. That could be where I'm having issues. Although I do have the layout for the PC board laid out, and included in it, it's actually two directional couplers, which do some interesting things. But yeah, I have to look into that. That makes a lot of sense. I'm sure what I should do is put the VNA on it. I'm sure at the extremes, I'm still looking at several thousand ohms, which as far as the RF is concerned should be, you know, plenty of nothing.
If you study your enclosure, you may really have the equivalent of fin line or double ridge coax cable, so the double ridge waveguide. In other words, the upper cover, the lower cover, and the sides, and the components in between acting as a shunt capacitor between the upper cover and the lower cover, you might really have waveguide mode. And so, depending on the dimensions of your box and the layout of your circuit, there could be all kinds of radiated path that's skirting around your beautiful switching network. Do you have the ability to get a hold of some radar-absorbing material, this conductive foam that you put on the covers of the box? And by the way, Do you get a change in this performance when you put the cover on and take the cover off? Maybe you've never put a cover on yet. Does the performance change? If you hold a piece of sheet metal above your circuit and you start off a foot away and you start moving it closer, and if the effects that you're undesiring get stronger and weaker cyclically, that would be a strong indication you've got radiated EMI aggravating your situation. The number of decibels you're looking for is going to require some pretty serious shielding between what you think is an input and what you think is an output, Eric, to get this 70 or more dB of isolation. You're pushing the state of the art, but it's doable, but you're going to have to work at it. Mother Nature's going to hold back the answer on this one for you for a while. You're going to have to work at it. Over to you, Eric, K2LAW.
I got you, Dickies. You opened my eyes. Actually, it's on a piece of purpoid with a couple of SMA connectors on it. It's really a very small thing, but yeah, there's no physical isolation between one end and the other. Whereas the PC board that I'm going to make is actually going to have a barrier. It's going to have its own little enclosure over the segment that the quarter wave line and the diode shunt with that. And then on the other side where the amplifier is going to be isolated from that. And it's going to be on a piece of FR4. Where the bottom side will be a ground plane. So, and I've got the directional couplers. Actually, one is used as a power sense, and the other is used as a reflected sense. It's just a matter of where you put the diodes on either end, and that works like a champ. But that needs to be isolated from everything else, too. But that's not part of the circuit at this point. That's not a metal little piece of perf board made with little pieces of foil with a couple of SMA connectors on it. It works great.
Now that I'm hearing the layout of your circuit, perf board, everything open air, not quite dead bug style, but getting close to it, and you're looking for 70 dB. 70 decibels is a 10 million to 1 ratio of power. If I had a 70 dB attenuator, that means the signal flowing through that attenuator, what comes out versus what goes in, is 10 million times weaker. And so that amount of radiation in air can easily happen. We're into this funny set of definitions here. To a ham radio operator building an antenna, he'd like to have 95% radiation efficiency of all the power he puts into it. He'd like 95% of it to be radiated into space somewhere. An electromagnetic compatibility engineer doing his shielding requirements, to him, 60 decibels of rejection, a million to one rejection, of what gets coupled through a circuit which versus what gets radiated in the air. He calls that failure. So that's what, 0.50 and 1% efficiency. He calls that a failure, and we're looking for 95% efficiency. So you're pushing the yard here when it comes to the circuit. I think you need a better layout before you stand a chance. I would say it's impossible. I have seen people with dead bug-like circuits where they know they're going to get radiation, but they put the certain portions of the circuit at right angles to each other by rotating them in azimuth, and other portions they put at right angles to each other by rotating them in elevation, cross-polarized, in other words. I've seen people build circuits with very careful layout in three-dimensional space so they can get away without putting a great big shielded structure around it. Very few people have that skill. And they push their luck for 60 dB of isolation with that. 70, I think, is pushing your luck, Eric. K2EJ.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Back to you, Eric. K2IW.
Hi, Jake. Yeah. Well, if you saw the way I used a piece of perf board, it's got no ground plane, but it's built out of copper foil because it's sort of a strip line the way I put it together. So, but yeah, no, you got me thinking. I'm thinking about all the stray capacitance involved. I mean, it does work fine, right spot on the center frequency that I set up the filter for, or the quarter wave line for. It really just looks like a filter anyway. But I'll let you know what happens. I'm gonna mechanically etch a PC board and see what happens. Thanks for the thought. It's very useful. K2RIW, K2J.
Listen, Wes recognized, hey, you're pushing the state of the art here a little bit, Eric. You're going to get there, but it's not going to be quite as simple and as easy and quick and dirty and fast as you'd like to. Building 450 megacycle RF circuits on perf board with a copper foil acting as a ground plane and another piece of copper foil acting as a strip line, you can do that. But to simultaneously get the shielding you're looking for and the isolation you're looking for and the on-off ratio, that's pushing it a little bit. Over to you, Wes. NQXJN, K2RIW.
Supposedly you have a bag that contains pin diode and control BIOS and RF DC return. Pin diode is supposed to act upon the signal strength, but the overall impedance of the bags in and out is supposed to be held with the impedance of the coaxial cable. How do you control that?
Yeah, there's a little bit of an ambiguity here, Wes. There's a kind of a power-limiting assembly you can buy, which usually has a... It looks like an attenuator. It's got a female connector on one end and a male connector, RF connector, on the other end. And inside, there's a Schottky diode plus pin diode. And so when a strong signal comes along, the strong signal gets rectified by the Schottky diode. That supplies a DC voltage to the pin diode, and the pin diode acts like a shunt. So therefore, it'll protect the receiver, for instance. You could have a pretty high-powered transmitter connected to a coax cable that goes to a receiver, and the receiver will be protected. A pin diode by itself is not a rectifier. It's a diode that's intentionally made very slow in its RF performance. You must apply a forward-biased DC current into a pin diode in order to make it active. The pin diode sitting there on the surface, if you do nothing to the pin diode, it's an open circuit, even for very large amounts of RF, within reason. But you start applying a forward biasing current of, let's say, 10 or 20 or 30 milliamperes. The pin diode goes from essentially an open circuit where its impedance is tens of thousands of ohms, maybe hundreds of thousands of ohms, and depending on which pin diode you use, with proper forward biasing, you can get them down to one ohm or a fraction of an ohm. So you put that thing in shunt of a coax cable going to a receiver. A one-ohm shunt on a 50-ohm line does a pretty good job of keeping a lot of the high power from getting into the receiver. So the pin diode really only gets turned on with DC current, RF signal on the pin itself.
By the way, it can be used as an attenuator.
Oh, yes. You can decide, because it's got a linear characteristic, as I slowly apply the forward current. If I start off at microamps and slowly work my way up to milliamps, I can make the apparent impedance, the resistive impedance of that diode, go from, let me pick a number, 10,000 ohms down to 1 ohm continuously. I can make a completely, thoroughly variable attenuator, an analog variable attenuator, where I can decide that my attenuator today is going to give me 30 dB of loss, 10 dB of loss, 3 dB of loss. I can choose any of those numbers by changing the DC current. And once you apply that DC current and you select that resistance, that gives you, let me drop, gives you that desirable amount of attenuation in your circuit, RF attenuation. If you now look with a fast oscilloscope at the RF voltage going across that pin diode, it is not a diode. It is not rectifying. When you choose the right pin diode, you choose a pin diode that has a carrier lifetime, so to speak. You might choose one that has a microsecond of response time, and yet you're feeding it a signal of 100 megacycles, which is 10 nanoseconds per cycle. So the pin diode does not have any rectification characteristic. You intentionally choose a pin diode for the circuit, which is very slow in its diode function at the operating frequency. So there's a bunch of compromises here, but properly used, they're very small, compact, fast, and they do some magic. There's a whole art and science to properly using a pin diode. It's a very unusual component. N2XJN, K2RIW, I hope that helps a little.
I have a problem with that. You said that we're dealing with the linear pardon, which I think it's not, you have a certain reducer resistance that is very high at a certain voltage. You have a very sharp slope down, and then as you increase the voltage, it doesn't change much. So when the bias on the PIN diode is varied, the microwave resistance changes, say, 6 kilo ohms under the negative bias to about 5 ohms when the bias is positive. So, and it doesn't happen only because you change the polarity. But my question was, how do you keep the input resistance impedance of the box containing the PIN diode at 50 ohm, say, the impedance of coaxial cable, using the diode as a rectifier at the same time, the output would also represent 50 ohm at 50.
Yeah, that's a good question. The inexpensive PIN diode assemblies, where the diode is being used as one simple element in shunt, the input impedance to your circuit, where you've got a 50-ohm input source and a 50-ohm load on the output side, and now when the PIN diode is inactive, you get 50 ohms in and out, no problem. As you start forward biasing the PIN diode, so it starts acting as a resistive shunt going down to something like an ohm, depending if you choose the right one, now the input impedance is going to have, in my example, if it was 1 ohm, you're going to have a 50-to-1 standing wave ratio. So a simple one diode shunt cannot do it, and that's a so-called reflective pin switch assembly. You can buy a non-reflective pin switch assembly by doing the following. Let me drop. You generate a pi network of pin diodes. By pi network, I mean from the coaxial input connector, you get one pin diode from the center conductor to ground. Then you have a pin diode in series with the center conductor. That's pin diode number two. Pin diode number three is again from center conductor to ground. Now you've got a separate biasing network on the series pin and the shunt pins. Because each of those pins, by way of the amount of forward current you put through the pin, you can make it act as a resistor, a pure resistor, so to speak, at these RF frequencies, anywhere from tens of thousands of ohms down to, let's say, 1 ohm. If you change the pins in the right ratio of this pi network, you can keep it 50 ohms in, 50 ohms out, and any amount of attenuation within reason that you want. You know that there's a whole way you can set up a pi network of three resistors so that when you choose those three resistors of the right values, you can make an attenuator of any number of decibels of attenuation you desire. 1 decibel, 3, 6, 10, 20, 40. Just choose the right ratio of those resistors. You can get a pure 50 ohm input, 50 ohm output attenuator of any number of decibels of attenuation you want. So where you put those three resistors in a typical pi resistor attenuator network, you put the three pins there, properly bias them, you'll do the exact same thing. N2XJN, K2RIW.
You can also do it by way of T. By the way, it's current dependent, not voltage dependent.
Yeah, I've been saying current. Wes keeps saying voltage. And yes, you can do it with voltage, but it's really the current the diode sees that determines its action. N2XJN, K2RIW.
I have a current problem with that as well. You have a certain voltage, and you have that high resistance. Okay, say you have 10 kilo ohms, 6 kilo ohms. Then you have a negative polarity, doesn't see the change. Then you have a change to the positive polarity, doesn't see the change. Only at a certain voltage that is specific for that diode, you see that once you increase the voltage, not the current yet, although the current doesn't exist without the voltage, then you see that the sharp slope is not the 90 degrees perpendicular to the voltage graph, but it's a sharp slope, and only from the beginning of the sharp slope down when the resistance is decreasing. Let me interrupt
you here. The RF voltage has no effect on the pin. It does not see the positive swing or the negative swing of the RF voltage. You choose the correct pin. It sees none of the RF voltage. It only sees the direct current DC bias that you put into the pin. That's all it sees. It is blind to the RF. You gotta remember that one, Wes. Over to you, K2LAW.
Don't forget that it doesn't work at like 500 kilohertz.
That's why I say you've got to carefully choose the diode that's appropriate for the frequency you're working at. When you choose the right pin diode, the pin diode as a rectifier is extremely slow compared to the frequency you're using it at. You may have chosen a pin that would be a rectifier up to 1 megacycle, and beyond that, it's not a rectifier anymore. But you're using at 100 megacycles, not 1 megacycle. Then you get all of these desirable characteristics where it does not see the RF. It is a pure resistor, whether it's the positive half cycle or the negative half cycle of the RF. It is a pure resistor at your RF frequency when you choose the right pin that's slow enough in its RF performance. Over to US K2RAW.
6DPZ in the comments.
Oh, one more thing. In a series pin diode, you need a path to ground to make it work.
Yep. In all cases, when you choose the pin diode resistance that you desire, by the way you set up your circuits with capacitive coupling and RF chokes and whatever, you have to completely control the current flowing through the diode, whether it's series, parallel, no matter what. You have to control the current the diode sees in order to get the proper pin operation. Wes first, and then Hal in that order. Go ahead, Wes.
I have no problem with that. Of course, it acts with the bias, which is the DC. So, but what I was trying to express is when the diode is mounted, say, across the transmission line or, say, waveguide, we have the loading effect that is insignificant while the diode is in, say, reverse bias. And the diode actually is represent no interference to the power flow. So when the diode is forward biased, the resistance drops, and then, say, 3 ohm, 5 ohm, and the most power is reflected. So, in other words, the diode acts as the switch between the mounted in parallel with the transmission line or waveguide. But you keep the guys saying current. It's a voltage factor that actually makes the trick.
You keep saying that, Wes, and you keep believing it. In this case, that is not the way it works. You have fallen into a trap. You've used good common sense. The pin diode does not work that way. K6DPZ, K2RAW, go ahead, Hal.
I was just reading the mail. Hello to everybody on TechNet. I wind up main problems on a lot of these transceivers that use pin diodes for antenna RF switching. And in a bind, I've used 1 amp 1000 volt diodes. I tie them in parallel, forward bias them, they're passive. You reverse them, they're not passive, they work up to 6 meters. I've had never a problem when I replace them in place of all these other sophisticated diodes in these transceivers. Go ahead.
Let me interrupt. The thing is that there is no current without the voltage. But you keep saying that the voltage is not important. So is there any voltage gap from which we have the effect? I see the graph in front of me. You've got to have a certain voltage, and then we create a certain current of DC through the bias circuitry.
Can you help him with this one?
Yeah, it turns out that you're right. Until you put something like 0.7 volt of forward voltage, you're not applying any current to the diode. You have to exceed the 0.7 volt, and after that, it is usually a constant current generating circuit that is feeding the pin diode in order to get the desirable operation. Without a doubt, you're right. There's a certain minimum voltage you have to apply before you can get that current there. But the average current the diode sees determines where it is operating on its variable resistance curve that could be from tens of thousands of ohms down to ohms. KE2EJ, K2RAW, go ahead, Eric.
Yeah, I just got to point out that, first of all, the thing that makes the pin diode special is this intrinsic layer that's between the P and the N junction. The time that it takes for things to move through the a little bit slow of the way it's doped. But the point that I try to make to Wesley is that in order to bias the pin diode, yes, you need the minimum voltage for where it's going to turn on, but the amount of current that passes through it, in many cases, you'll have a circuit where there'll be a choke feeding the input voltage, and somewhere a resistor which goes to ground or back to the return path of whatever the voltage source is, of a particular value to bring that diode to operate at a very specific current. Like the diodes that I'm using fully turn on at a milliamp. And you can vary the voltage across it. As long as you're drawing a milliamp, it's always going to have that same amount of attenuation, or none in this particular case. P2RWK to eject.
Particularly, you're forward biasing the diode to saturation.
In the case of the very crafty power diodes you were using, Hal, a poor man's equivalent of a pin diode, which works like a charm, yeah, you were using the saturation characteristics of rectifying diodes. The real pin diodes, PIN stands for positive, intrinsic, negative. You're describing the three layers that are in series inside that diode. That intrinsic region, the region that's not doped in between the P section on the left and the N section on the right, that intrinsic section in between is what makes it RF slow. It has to be RF slow so you're not getting RF rectification. If the diode was responding to your RF, it would be generating harmonics and intermodulation distortion if there's more than one signal present. For the pin diode to do its thing, it has to be a pure resistor across the full 0 to 360 degrees of phase angle of the RF signal. It is a pure resistor across that whole RF waveform when you choose the right pin diode for your particular frequency region. Very handy devices, but it takes a fair amount of study to figure out how they're being used. And about the best thing I could recommend is I know there are a number of good websites. Let me drop them. Where if you Google the word pin diode, and if you study some of the circuits, many of the rigs that we own in the transmit-receive function on the output side of the transceiver, you've got pin diodes. And if you study the way the schematic diagram of your rig is using those pin diodes, you'll get some hints as to what it's doing. Hewlett-Packard has a number of application notes on pin diodes. I think they were the main manufacturer of these things way back in the 60s when these things started becoming popular. And Hewlett-Packard had some beautiful application notes. I'd like to believe there's a website somewhere where you can download those application notes. And when you see all those graphs and you read all the words, it will become more clear. There's a whole lot of fancy functions inside of that little bitty diode envelope. And with any further questions or comments on pin diodes, give me a call that is right now.
I'll give you a website.
Go right ahead.
All right, there's a couple manufacturers today. I happen to be using one from MACOM. You go to the MACOM website, type in pin diode, you see a whole series of white papers, including one on how to select the pin diode. There are a couple of other big manufacturers they have, and if you look, it's funny because you look at the white papers from manufacturer to manufacturer, they're the same, just retyped in a different order, which is really funny. P2RIWK to eject.
One interesting question would be, what is the capacitive reactance across a point contact diode if we try to compare it with normal junction diode?
All diodes have a measurable amount of capacitance, and almost all diodes, the amount of capacitance you measure in picofarads will change as you change the bias voltage on the diode. So there is something called varactor diodes. The diodes that are put into a voltage-controlled oscillator, which is part of a phase-lock loop assembly, those varactor diodes are carefully selected to have very desirable characteristics, where in some cases I think you can almost hit the 20-to-1, 30-to-1 change in ratio of capacitance as you change the bias voltage on a varector diode. Schottky, the real varector diodes, some of them have different kinds of curve of voltage versus capacitance, depending on how they're doped. And you can get this effect out of a Schottky diode, but I think the normal varector diodes that are selected for that service might not be a pure Schottky diode. It's a little bit more exotic than that. That's not the whole story, but it's the beginning of the story, Wes. K2LAW.
We beat up the subject. Thank you very much.
K6DPZ with one more comment.
Yeah, when it comes to pin diodes that you select to be pure pin in function, when you get down to, let me pick a number, 10 megacycles or lower, maybe even 500 megacycles or lower, there are very few pins that exist these days that work down there. When you're starting to operate at HF frequencies, you're really not using a pin anymore. You're using power rectifiers like Hal has been telling us about. K6DPZ, K2LAW, go ahead, Hal.
Tell me to go through. Yeah, years ago, we used to put PL on all types of old radios. And what you did, you used a regular silicon diode. You went off the Austin crystal with a little cap, of tatter cap, into a silicon diode to ground. And then you fed your signal through a 10K resistor from the subaudible tone. And you adjusted a trimmer little compression cap until you had the maximum amount of clean subaudible tone that you could see. And that's what we used to modulate the direct modulation of PL on a lot of the radios out there. Go ahead, Dick.
And that PL oscillator, it has to be mounted before your, or it's got to be mounted right at the oscillator itself, the voltage-controlled oscillator. There are people who try to inject PL tones into the microphone circuit of a rig, and therefore all the audio coming through your microphone going into a well-designed FM transmitter has a pre-emphasis network where it favors the high frequencies compared to the low frequencies, and then the receiver, there is a de-emphasis network that takes that function back out again. You get the most desirable FM transmission characteristics when you do that, but you're really fuxing that circuit, that pre-emphasis circuit, if you put the PL tone in front of that pre-emphasis network. It's got to be after. It's got to be closer to the real varector diode. I bet you've seen a number of these rigs where people have added a PL generator. They put it in the wrong spot, and you end up with some pretty yucky-sounding audio and not very linear-sounding PL tones. I bet you've run into a few of those during your service. Is that true, Hal? K6DPZ, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Oh, yeah. No, I've seen all sorts of problems. See, if a FM transmitter is phase modulated, you could go right in on the LOD pot, the IDC pot, and put your subaudible tone. But if it's not phase modulated, it's direct FM, but you use a varactor for modulation, then you have to use a silicon diode to impose also the subaudible tone, because you have direct and indirect FM, which Dick could explain. I'll take. You give a long explanation, Dip. I don't want to shut that one off.
It's the lowest frequency for pin diode.
I think you've got very few pin diodes these days that are rated for frequencies below, I'm going to pick a number, 50 megahertz. When it comes to 1 gigahertz, my guess is there's a zillion pin diodes you can select, but below 50...
10 megahertz diode.
Okay, 10 megs. So you know of a 10 meg. I bet you if you wanted to go below 10 megs, you've almost got nothing to select. Is that roughly true, Eric?
Actually, there is. They make them that go down to a little over a megahertz, but they're really, really expensive. I mean, the ones that I'm buying are like $8 a piece. So, you know, you're making a lot of stuff, but and you need a bunch of them, it adds up real quick. But, you know, I'm not a manufacturer, so. But, yeah, they're available. But the interesting thing about pin diodes is you go below the frequency in which they operate, you now have a bottom clipper, and it looks fun on the scope.
It'll give you an exotic waveform, but in some cases that waveform ain't going to sound good. If that was a sideband signal, you're going to have crossover distortion and flat topping distortion. If it was part of the network that's transmitting audio, yes, you get a fancy picture on the oscilloscope, but it's not a desirable signal to transmit. Is that roughly true, Eric? Go ahead.
No, it's a great harmonic noise generator, that's for sure. If you look at it on a spectrum analyzer, you can see all the harmonics going out as far as it'll ring. But yeah, no, you don't want to do that.
Yeah, give us an update as the weeks go by, Eric. You've got a very interesting circuit you've been building for this pin diode switching network for your DMR function of afterburner. It's one of the things I think you're building it for. Also probably for greater understanding of pin diode type transmit-receive circuits. So give us an update from time to time because it's an interesting project you're on. I think it can be very educational. Very similar to what's been going on with Rich, N2EO, as he's been doing a step-by-step troubleshooting of his high-power amplifier. Why can't I think of the brand name of the thing? John, what's the brand name?
Henry.
That's it, Henry 2K. And so we had all kinds of speculations with the early symptoms versus what we finally thought it was, and we all got surprised. The crazy characteristics of his Henry 2K was really an arc over of a portion of a air filter coming near a high-voltage circuit, arcing over to it. Okay, Steve, KC2MDP, I think was the call letters. I believe he had a question. I hope you're still with us, Steve. Hope we haven't put you to sleep. KC2MDP, question mark. I hope I got the call letters right. K2RIW, you got it, Steve.
Yes, very good, Dick. Yes, it's Steve, KC2, Mike Delta Papa. Basically, I have two questions. I got a real quick one for Eric, and then that will have a bearing on the question I ask you. The question I want to ask Eric, is the 1288 Limewalk machine up and running? Back to you.
As far as I know, it is, but that doesn't mean it is. I checked it out, I think it was about 3 months ago, and it was still living, so it's possible it's there, and it's possible it's not there. It wouldn't be the first time that's happened.
I've not been able to key the Limewalk machine for a month on 1296, N2MB.
Give us a few words on that, Barry. The rig that you use runs how many watts? You're pretty close to that repeater. I'm guessing you can easily pick it up with a handy talkie on 1296 if you've got one. And so so I think you're saying for the last week or so, no matter what you use, it does not come alive. Is that approximately it, Barry? N2 Mike Bravo, K2LAW.
2 weeks. I have not been able to bring it up. And it's it usually comes in very, very strong. It just pins an needle. It's always very loud, and it's not there. So I'm assuming it's not working. It was sputtering about 2 weeks ago. It was acting funny, and now I don't hear it at all.
Okay, sounds like I got something else to fix. By the way, any of you guys operate 220? How's that thing doing?
That 220, I never use it. When I get home, I'll check it.
220, beautiful audio. That's probably got the best audio out of any of the Limewalk repeaters.
And Steve, how long ago did you hear that 220? Was it as early as today?
No, probably last week.
Okay, that's a good sign. Now, when it comes to 1296, 1288 megacycles, not many of the guys are that progressive. They're expensive rigs. Give me a rough guess, Eric. What's the greatest number of people you've ever heard go through that repeater? If you kept a logbook of everyone you ever heard going through that New York City 1288 repeater, roughly how big is that list? Is it 3 guys or 30 guys? N2 Moonbounce, K2RIW.
I really don't keep track of it, but usually I could go for days and nobody's using it. And then you could hear a couple of guys talking on it, and that's it. It's not very popular. It should be, because when it's working great. It's the easiest one for me to get into, and I can get into it from pretty far north of here. I can go all miles north of New York and still get into it. So, I don't know. I wish it would be more popular.